Today's program is brought to you by Austin East Ciders. For more information, visit their website at austineastciders.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Afternoon, and welcome back to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liu, and we're broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Today is our very first episode since the summer break, and we're so excited to get underway with the season, as there will surely be lots of exciting food industry and policy news coming down the pike. And we're going to kick off the season by talking to an awesome organization called Drive Change, which operates at the intersection of criminal justice and food system reform. Joining me today to do so is Jordan Lexton, co-founder of Drive Change, and Fred Coleman, a former Drive Change fellow. But before we speak with them, Taylor Lanzett, my associate producer, is in the studio with me today to talk through some of the biggest food news from the past couple of weeks. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, Jenna.
Welcome back.
So excited to be here.
Great. What's been happening since we've been on break?
Yeah. So first up, I figured we could ease back into the news with your classic weather update.
Oh, yeah.
So the drought hit New York pretty hard this year. We're talking about 26 counties across the state that have been marked as natural disaster areas, which makes them eligible for emergency farm service agency loans.
I mean, I feel like it hasn't rained a lot this summer. My own sort of anecdotal
beach time.
But what does this really mean in terms of rainfall?
It ranges from deficits of 6 to 9 inches, with some farmers having seen crop loss up to about 50%. So pretty sizable.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah.
What else? All right. Okay. Yeah. Weather update done.
Done.
Depressing.
Well, our favorite topic, SNAP, has had some summer fun.
All right.
As we reported last season, there are a lot of efforts in motion to get online retailers set up to accept SNAP. So Senator Cory Booker and Representative Tim Ryan and Barbara Lee are collectively urging the USDA to catch up and move its timeline to get programs piloted and up and running. They have also asked the USDA to process SNAP benefits at point of purchase online, not when the food is delivered.
That's interesting. I think this is great. I love Senator Booker.
Yeah.
Not just because of his convention speech and awesome food work, but just because he's an amazing person. But for our listeners, I just wanted to remind everybody the 2014 Farm Bill allocated resources to make sure the USDA get these pilot programs up and running.
Yeah, and the USDA is going to request that volunteer retailers this fall show themselves, and that by the end of the year, they should have some retailers selected.
Yeah.
And as we talked about last season, like Thrive Market, based in LA, is one of the major ones that they're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
It should be pretty exciting.
I know. And I don't know why a retailer wouldn't want to do this. I think it would be a win-win for everybody involved.
So in breaking news.
Breaking news. Flashing across your... your mind.
We'll work on that next time. Monsanto announced today that it will be acquiring its rival Bayer, or will be acquired by its rival Bayer in the largest takeover so far this year. To seal the deal, Bayer has pumped even more money into this. Monsanto is the USC giant, and so they're valuing it at $66 billion, including Monsanto's debt.
Wow. So this is the third time Bayer has upped the ante, I guess. Third time's a charm. But this takeover is going to, if it goes forward, create a vast conglomerate, to say the least, spanning pharmaceuticals, health products, pesticides. Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how the farming landscape looks after this.
I know.
And, of course, this is pending myriad antitrust regulatory hurdles.
Like a long haul there for them, I hope, I guess.
I hope so, too.
It seems this is huge. And so we'll be reporting on more of this as it kind of unfolds. But, it's, as of now, moving forward.
Yeah. So... Last week, the USDA announced that U.S. households experiencing food insecurity dropped from 14% in 2014 to 12.7% in 2015. So this is actually quite a bit. And it's still higher than pre-recession numbers of 11.1%, but it's a downward trend that hopefully we'll see continuing.
Yeah, this was really big news when it came out last week, and it was good news, obviously. But since maybe my role today is going to be to put a damper on all of the good news coming down, I also think it's worth mentioning that there was an article that came out recently in The Guardian that talks about kids in poor communities who are hungry enough to trade sex, sell drugs, join gangs for food. And it was just really depressing. So the researcher, Susan Popkin, who's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, led this qualitative study and interviewed 200 kids in urban and rural areas across the country. And, you know, one of the things she said was that these teens overwhelmingly wanted to earn money in other ways for food, but there weren't a lot of options, other options available.
Wow. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out. I mean, clearly the 12.7% food insecurity still means we have a lot of work to do. And, you know, those numbers are even higher sometimes for children or children who are living on their own.
Yeah. And I just think that, you know, we throw a lot of numbers out there when we're talking about food insecurity and these issues. And one of the reasons I think it's important to mention this today is because it really helps, like, humanize these numbers and really explain kind of how dire this situation can be for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And speaking of teens, researchers from UPenn conducted a follow-up study from earlier this year regarding soft drink consumption and warning labels. So in a survey of more than 2,000 teens, they found that 8 to 16% were likely to not choose a sugar-sweetened beverage if it came with a label showing possibilities of obesity, diabetes, or tooth decay.
8 to 16% doesn't seem like a huge number.
Right.
I mean, I was, like, excited about this, but then I was like, but wait.
Yeah. But so 62% of teens who participated in this survey said that they would support a policy of putting warning labels on sugary drinks.
Okay, so
that's huge.
That's
62%.
Huge. Yeah, if they vote.
if
we actually can, like, you know,
get them
galvanize them to the polls. Staying on this topic. Just as a reminder, sorry, there have been a few bills introduced this past year in California, Baltimore, and New York that would require such a warning label to be placed on drinks, sugary drinks. So far, San Francisco is the only city to have passed this type of legislation, which went into effect this summer.
Yeah. And on sort of an additional note on that, the former NYC Mayor Michael Bloomberg has given $1.5 million to support the proposed ballots in SF and Oakland for the 1 cent per ounce tax on sugary beverages.
Yeah, I'm obviously super biased on this one, as I'm going to say he's always been ahead of the curve on issues like this. But, you know, it's really important for the, like, pro-tax proponents to have an advocate like Bloomberg in their corner.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, someone to – the soda lobby has a lot of money. So having someone push against that in a meaningful way. And I would really love to see a multi-tiered effort with a label and a tax, which is not surprising because I love more regulations for soda business. Okay. Last up. I just have to mention this because you know how much I also love councils. Secretary of Ag Tom Vilsack, most recently famed for being a potential Hillary Veep pick. Of course, he did not get that. But he has been sort of advertising that the next administration should essentially make a White House food council. So he's, you know, his advice here is that this group would bring together people and sort of, you know, topical areas from ag to tech to access.
This would be, I mean, a lot of people have talked about this maybe as like a pie in the sky, but it would be such an awesome win for the food community if this got actioned.
Yeah. And Jenna, just think, maybe they will need people who can report food news.
I think,
and we can just tap ourselves.
I think we should definitely tap ourselves. consider ourselves tapped for such a position. I mean, Secretary Vilsack, if you're listening, please consider us for the White House Food Policy Council. We can do it.
We could do it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's it for our food news today. If you have any suggestions for stories that you would like to hear us to reporting on or questions and thoughts on the ones today, be sure to tweet at us at EatMattersHRN. Okay, turning to our story at hand for the day, we are going to be talking to Drive Change. And I want to welcome to the show Executive Director Jordan Lexton and Fred Coleman, a former Drive Change fellow. Jordan and Fred, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us. Really happy to be here.
Jordan, let's start with you. What is Drive Change exactly?
Drive Change uses the food truck industry to run a fellowship for young people who are coming home from jail and prison. So I was a teacher on Rikers Island for a number of years and developed a concept where we could use the food truck business as a tool to support employment needs and skill training development, community building for young people who are coming home.
Can you give us a brief macro and micro understanding of our criminal justice system in New York just to help us set the stage? And,
yeah,
and
super
where
easy
issue-
to do that.
Yeah, no problem. Just in, you know, in like a soundbite.
Drive Change was founded because of pervasive injustice that I witnessed firsthand from working inside of Rikers and working particularly with young people. New York is actually one of two states that automatically treats a 16-year-old like they're an adult in the criminal justice system. So witnessing firsthand extremely abusive conditions, the very real existence of racial injustice, of issues around a class and disparity, people who just don't have access to opportunity getting wrapped up into our criminal justice system, and the very long-lasting consequences that being even just arrested can have. So really witnessing, again, how young people who, because of this issue in New York with the age, are leaving with felonies as opposed to juvenile adjudications, which means they have open, not closed records.
Right.
So imagine coming home, you're 16, 17, 18 years old, thinking about your future, and the road ahead just looks to be paved with these dead ends, these red lights, these stop signs. You can't find work. You can't go back to school. There are issues around even public housing where you can live. And so the likelihood that somebody's going to get re-wrapped up in the system at that age is almost 70%. And we're talking about a system where it costs close to $200,000 a year to incarcerate a single individual inside of Rikers Island. So clearly, this is a system that needs a desperate, desperate overhaul.
Right. And how, in your opinion, is the industrial food system similar to the prison industrial complex? You mentioned racial injustice as a theme. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm a white person who grew up in New York City on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and who throughout
not an underserved neighborhood.
No, certainly not. My life, there were open doors. There was constant access to opportunity. And from an early age, it was kind of clear to me that that pathway of what is possible was very broad. And then being a teacher inside of Rikers, 95% of the population of young adults who are actually incarcerated are young people of color. It is a systemic racist system that creates those kinds of disparities. It is not just class. It is not just the fact that somebody who is, mind you, Rikers Island is mostly people just detained, so not guilty of anything.
Right.
They can only, they're there mostly because they cannot afford bail. Yet a person of the same economic class who goes through the system, if one person is a person of color and one person is a white person, the conditions and the outcome is usually worse for a young person of color still, regardless, even if it's the same crime, same kind of pathway. So we're talking about a inherently unjust system that exists within the criminal justice system. And you asked about
food. Yeah,
food.
How it relates to food.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so my background is really truly in the education educational space and the criminal justice space, but in building Drive Change and at Drive Change, we actually, the model is that we own and operate our own food truck business, which is called Snow Day, and Snow Day actually won the Vendy Award for best food truck in New York City last year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And our model has been all about being able to use food from local farms as the platform for our seasonal menu. And so I've gotten really exposed to food and food justice through the process of building and starting Drive Change and through the expertise and experience of people like our culinary arts director, Jared Spafford, who has very clearly for his whole life been dedicated to the same idea that is an issue with race and injustice in the criminal justice system, which is about access.
Right.
Access and opportunity, exposure, the ability for these things to be things that are truly open and truly able for people of any background to be able to obtain. And our current model of society creates restrictions specifically to people of color and specifically around race.
If I may, absolutely.
Right,
if you look at the situations, like, okay, most of the people who go to prison come from like really poor neighborhoods. You look at most of the poor neighborhoods, it's really crappy food, right?
Yeah.
Really crappy. So if you take a whole bunch of like really, I'll choose my words carefully because. I'm not sure if we can curse on radio, but like if you take a whole bunch of like negative things and pump negative things into a person, you get a negative person.
You get a negative outcome.
Then you become, then you lock this negativity away. Let this negativity out and give this negativity no opportunity to become positive. What do you get?
Can you tell us, Fred, about your own experience and, you know, with Drive Change specifically and where you are now?
I mean, like, if I had to give, like, a real, like, one word, it, Drive Change was exhausting. Trying to, like, broaden people's horizon, shed some light on something people didn't know was even going on. I mean, before Drive Change, I kind of didn't even know myself. Like, I didn't know that, you know, I was pushed into this.
Certain systems and structures. Yeah.
And then Jordan, you know, being Jordan, educator, she enlightened me on a lot of that stuff. So to try to teach people, like, the same thing Jordan showed me is exhausting. And then, I mean, the food did make it a lot easier.
So what were some of the things that you did in the program that that you received training on?
Oh, man, everything. Like, I have very rarely written essays. I've very rarely done... I've, a lot of the food I worked with was unbelievable.
So there's culinary training.
There's culinary training. Jordan really...
Was there, like, hospitality and stuff?
There's a lot of that, too. But Jordan was a lot, like, pushy with making me do paperwork and other stuff like that. So like, I did a lot of that. I did a lot of PR stuff. I mean, I wasn't a real talkative guy. Like, I could, you know, but I'm 6'3", 200-something pounds. I didn't really have to say much to people. And Jordan kind of, like, pushed me out there and was like, hey, go tell people what we do. And it's like, oh, man, I'm really good at that.
Yeah.
I can really tell people some stuff. So I became a little bit more vocal and, you know.
And confident.
I definitely confident. I smile a lot more now also. You know, I didn't know I had a really nice smile.
You do. Well, that's a fact. Yeah. And I think that's amazing. So it seems like the program has had such a positive effect on you.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, now where I work at and like the two places I work at really just like really focus on great food.
And where is that?
I work at the Union Square 14th Street Market,
the Green Market.
And Raynard's, which is the White Hotel. North 11th Street.
So for all of our non-New York-based listeners, that is a very fancy hotel in Williamsburg from the restaurateur Andrew Tarlow, right?
Yeah. And the chefs there are kind of like their culinary arts director at drive change. They're really, like, really overly passionate about the food that they put out and how it looks. And when it, like, you should see, like, when the food comes in, how they're, like, looking at it and touching. And it's unbelievable. So to see something like that and be around those type of people, it wouldn't be possible if I didn't, like, get the knowledge or education I did from working with Drive Change.
So, Jordan, ever since starting the program, when was Drive Change founded, by the way?
2014. So we've worked, the model is a one-year fellowship. It works with about 16 young people per year. Like Fred and you just talked about, we're using the business as the platform for all the training that we're doing. So all of our fellows are prepping all of our food from scratch. They're then selling the food off the truck to our consumers. And in that moment, really, we encourage everybody to be engaging in a way that creates a human connection, recognizing that through point of sale and through hospitality, we can eradicate some of the stigma that comes with incarceration and simultaneously raise awareness about injustice inside of the system. And then we do professional development every week of about 6 hours a week, again, teaching these transferable skills and using the business as the tool. So we started in 2014. We've worked so far with about 19 young people total.
Why food specifically? You know, as the industry that you chose to really kind of drive.
Why not food? I mean,
that's a very good question. No, that's a great question.
How do you get people talking? How do you get people around together thinking about anything? You know, you can bring enemies together with food, like.
Because it brings people together.
Yeah, you know, think about, like, Thanksgiving alone. Like, everybody from everywhere, from, like, family members you haven't seen from a while, years, come over to sit down at grandmother's house, and everybody's sitting there.
Matter what's going on in that family.
You may hate your uncle, but you're, like, sitting across the table from him, and you're like, wow, we both haven't had her food in ever. And it's like, we're going to eat, we're going to try to get along, and then after you're about, like, on your third plate, you're kind of too tired to fight. So you just smile at each other, you just enjoy each
too
other.
Too much turkey.
I think that's really right. I mean, I think that, like, food is it's a complete human language, you know, and it is something, like, the power of a shared meal is a really incredible thing. Specifically, you know, when I was teaching on Rikers, one of the only classrooms and areas where people were happy, focused, disciplined, excited was a culinary arts class. So I started to think about how, like, the way in which a food business really does teach these both soft and hard skills to people. But it's, you know, you need to be a part of it. You need to be a team player. You need to be able to be in the high intensity of a kitchen space. And those kind of problem solving skills are skills that you're going to take with you throughout the rest of your life. Also, you know, food, I mean, it's just, it is about that human connection. It is about the reality that we've been able to use our great food as a platform for dialogue around some of these conversations that deal with the intersectionality between race and class, food justice, and the criminal justice system. And that's something that, you know, if the model was not centered around something like a shared meal, it just wouldn't have happened.
Right. I love what you said, Fred, why not food? It's something that resonates with me personally because, you know, for instance, when I tell people I have a radio show and it's on food policy, I think most people think that's a very niche topic, but it's not, is sort of the point of the show, right? Food affects us every single day, several times a day, and, you know, not just food, but our food environment. And anyways, that's to say, I love that comment, I'm going to use it. Why not food when people ask me that? Okay, so we're going to take a quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the role of policy and what Drive Change is doing to advocate for criminal justice reform while championing food system access and sustainability.
And this one is called Walking Like a Cowboy by Tackstar. We'll be right back.
Are you an East Sider? We live on the east side of town. Our shipping container studios are at Roberta's in Bushwick, across the East River, separating New York City and Brooklyn. In all my recent travels, it seems like the east side of town is the cool side of town in cities across the country. East Nashville is full of musicians and weird bars. The up-and-coming neighborhood around 8th Street in D.C., on the east side, is overflowing with exciting food and nightlife. The best hidden spots and funky artists in New Orleans are in the Marigny and Bywater, which, yup, is the east side of town. So, as East Siders, we love drinks that represent our values. And nothing is more fitting than a cool, refreshing can of Austin East Siders. As the name implies, it is cider, and it's handmade on, you guessed it, the east side of Austin, Texas, using bittersweet and bittersharp cider apples. Cider apples are full of tannins, adding astringency and complexity of flavor to every sip. Austin East Siders uses a mixture of European and Pacific Northwest apples to achieve ultimate flavor. Austin East Siders is available in a few different variations, including original flavor, Texas honey, and two new additions, hopped and pineapple. Here at Heritage Radio, we love Austin East Siders with some ribs, pulled pork, and even pizza, especially Roberta's pizza. You can find out more at austineastsiders.com. And remember to hashtag East Siders to show your East Side pride. You can also find Austin East Siders on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we are speaking with Jordan Lexton and Frederick Coleman of the nonprofit organization Drive Change. Jordan, does Drive Change advocate for specific policy changes? And if so, which ones?
Specifically, we are focused on a campaign to raise the age of adult criminal responsibility in New York. Mm-hmm. It's something that has been brought to the floor in the past 2 years, but actually not passed. New York is, as I said at the beginning of the show, we use 16 as the benchmark for adult responsibility, which just has ridiculous consequences for young people. And New York is actually one of only two states, North Carolina being the other, where the age is set that low. So that is very much a focus for the work that we're doing at Drive Change. We're right now involved also in a campaign to close Rikers Island.
Really?
Yeah, it's being spearheaded by a remarkable organization called Just Leadership USA, founded by Glenn Martin, who is an incredible, incredible advocate for reform. So we're a part of that specific campaign as well. And, you know, again, thinking too about bail reform. Why are people, specific people, being detained when they don't have to be? And that the method of how that leads itself into decriminalization of certain crimes.
Right.
So those are the main and specific policies that we are currently working on.
Anything around food advocacy?
Yeah, so as it relates to food access and food justice, we're not right now, there isn't any particular bill or particular policy that we are deep diving, honing into to get behind specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're thinking more and more about how the mobility of what we do, being that we are a food truck and have the capacity to get out in the community and get out in lots of different areas, how we can use that mobility to our advantage to get out into neighborhoods and talk about access and ask people, what are your challenges? How, you know, what would get you into a position in place where potentially you could be providing more nutritious meals for your family? And being able to ask also our city's leaders, how do we create infrastructure that supports that? And one of the things that we're working on is building a food truck commissary that would also be a hub for some of this access point for other food truck businesses and for communities in general. So
like a communal kitchen where you would all food truck operators would be able to prepare
Yeah, exactly. Like a co-working space for food trucks with incubator kitchen space, classroom space for the trainings that we do, but also have it be consumer-facing and have it be a space where the possibility for distribution and for food access, you know, kind of creating this charter of, like, what kind of food we would also want to encourage businesses to be able to afford so that they can sell to consumers as well. That shared space and that food truck commissary is the vision for our growth at Drive Change.
Fred, I want to talk about food access a little bit more, and specifically lack of healthy food access. Is this something that you have personally experienced?
Yeah. So I grew up, for the first part of my life, I grew up in, like, Spanish Harlem, where, like, literally steps from, like, the inner city, and, you know, having seen people, how can I put it, like, seeing someone in a three-piece suit and seeing someone sagging their pants, like, within footsteps of each other.
Right.
So if I walk uptown, obviously I'm going to see someone sagging and dragging their pants or whatever. Walk towards the city, see someone, like, getting into their Porsche or something like that, you know? And literally,
and you're talking about the division,
the borderline of, like, I would,
the Upper East Side and Harlem.
So now you're in this, like, building with all the same people who are, like, sagging their pants. This literally was your way. Like, okay, I have to do this. I have to, you know, fit in with my crowd, you know, not knowing, like, that's also your crowd. Like, we are all human.
Right.
Right? But then when you start thinking about your food and how you handle food, and, like, my mother married my father, he's from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So he grew up in, like, that time where you were, like, pumped the worst part of the animal. Like, I guess let's say the worst part, because a lot of the whole animal was incredibly delicious, but like, he was pumped what was called the negative part of the animal, like the worst part of the animal, and I had to grow up eating that. And, like,
what would that be?
I mean, like I said, it's all delicious. I mean, literally, but, like, chitlins, like pig's feet, like pig ears.
Okay,
like, then you would never get, like, a really good steak.
Right, like a pork chop or something.
Like, you don't get the best pork chop. If you were getting a pork chop, you were getting, like I said before, about, like, the supermarkets, like, how you look at supermarkets. Like,
So his influence was from the South.
Yeah, and, I mean, it was all great food, and, you know, Grandma really did do a great job with it. But then you look at stuff like ramen noodles, right? Like, ramen sucks. Mm-hmm. It's, like, not good for you at all. It's, like, pumped full of... I was told it had styrofoam in it, too. Like, I'm not entirely
sure. It probably
does,
yeah.
Like, so now it's, like, you grow up and you're eating, like, ramen noodles. Like,
do you think that's... I mean, you mentioned the kind of societal pressure a little bit earlier. Do you think part of that is, like, what your friends are eating? And so...
Literally, everyone... Hey, dude, you're coming over. We're hanging out. Hey, I'm about to make me a ramen noodle. Do you want one?
Right. So it's
of,
like,
of course I want a ramen noodle. Why not?
Well, I mean, in all fairness, ramen's really good. Also tasty. Maybe not
for you. See, but that's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Like, if you know, before I start, like, blasting a whole bunch of, like, companies and organizations with really crappy food, the point of it's supposed to taste good.
You're right.
It's supposed to taste like, but then you think about, right,
you put enough sodium in anything and you can,
then you think about the problems that you have later on in life, and you don't relate it back to this cheeseburger that you had, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, it was delicious. I'm full. I go home. Then I have cancer. Uh-huh. And then, you know, or you can literally, like, break down to, like, the greatest of products, you know, kick out, you know, maybe a few extra bucks to actually have this great product, you know, and then, you know, feel a little bit better about yourself, you know, feel a little bit, you know, not so worn down and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not have cancer or, you know, I mean, like I said, like me going from eating ramen noodles every day to now, I don't even shop at the supermarket.
Where do you shop then?
Market. I mean, I get
at the Green Market.
I got a really good discount over there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the Union Square Green Market is very famous, even to people not in New York, but has a lot of awesome options.
So, like, literally, like, I can go there, get really good food. I can give my children great food.
Yeah.
You know, and not have to go and not have to really think about, like, oh, what are the consequences for them, for me giving them this now?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think those points are so important because it is then also about affordability, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, who has access to the green markets? Who's able to buy that food for their kids?
Like, literally, the people who live in that neighborhood. Like, mm-hmm. I'm in the Bronx now. Like, there's very rarely I see anybody from my neighborhood down at the market or people I know at the market.
Yeah.
Like, I've had one person in... He was literally just straggling around the market.
Yeah. Well, it's a long way away from the Bronx.
But you do have things like Hunts Point up in the Bronx. And so it's a question also, too, of, you know, not just physical access, but also like awareness around it. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the systems in place to be able to help educate people about where they can get food that they can afford that's better for them and better for their kids? But I also just really want to touch on what Fred said about the food, like, crappy food tasting good.
Mm-hmm.
That is intentional, right? Like capitalism is wrapped up in this. And so when people in poor neighborhoods are being sold food that is literally addictive and affordable
and cheap,
then it continues to create this cycle and problem. And so it's not just about is this now accessible, but it's about literally like changing people's behaviors, which is extremely challenging.
That was funny because someone came, I mean, not to like beat on people who drink Hennessy, but I was told that like Hennessy and fried chicken was supposed to be like this like hallucinated thing for black people. Like it makes black people hallucinate and do things they shouldn't do. It was probably an inside joke, but it was funny, and maybe it's true. Who knows? Maybe we should talk to Hennessy and the fried chicken people.
I like fried chicken any which way, with no matter what.
Maybe it's the fried chicken in the neighborhood that we were talking about, but it was a great joke at the time.
Does Snow Day work in any of these underserved areas, or like, you know, do you park there? Do you have a certain designated location that you go to every week?
Yeah. So the answer is that not frequently enough.
Right.
So one thing that we've tried really hard to do, and this has actually been supported by great partners. So we have partners at the Randall's Island Urban Farm and also the Battery Park Urban Farm who donate produce to us weekly.
Oh, okay.
So what partially that allows us to do is keep our prices relatively low.
Right.
Our average price point on our menu is $7, which is just not common anywhere, really. Especially if you move within the areas that we tend to vend. Right now, we're parking in Bryant Park on Tuesdays, and we're down the Financial District on Thursdays. We're going to be ramping up our schedule come this fall also, too. We're doing a lot of private events as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of being in neighborhoods where access is way more important, part of what we've also flirted with doing and what we want to be able to do, and hopefully we'll have the infrastructure to do it, is to have a sliding scale menu, depending on where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Let us be in a position and in a place where people who can afford to pay at a higher value.
Do so.
Learning also as well that the money that you, whenever you buy food at Snow Day, that money just recycles back into the organization to subsidize our overall operating costs. So it goes back into programming, back into the work that we're doing, back into supporting the community that we're building.
Mm-hmm.
And so, putting people in a position where if you can afford to pay for food at a certain level, do doing so.
Based on your neighborhood.
Based on your neighborhood. And then being able for us to go into neighborhoods that don't get access to the quality of food that we serve off of Sode and to really sell it at a price that is either pay as you can or is at a lower rate.
Yeah.
And so that's something that our culinary arts director, Jared, is extremely passionate about. And I really think that over the course of the next year, you'll see a lot more of that from us, which is very exciting.
Yeah, I love that concept. And I just had actually one of the co-founders on the show, David Foster of Every Table, which is a new LA-based restaurant chain that does exactly that. They have like a fluctuating pricing strategy that varies depending on the neighborhoods that they serve. It's an interesting concept, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But part of me wonders at the same time, while I think that it's a great concept, the food advocate in me thinks, is it that simple and should food be cheap?
Yeah.
Right? Should good food be cheap, and how does that relate to your suppliers and the supply chain?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I wonder if Fred also has some insight into this, but I know Jared, our culinary arts director, thinks about that all the time because he believes firmly that, quality food should be paid for at a, you know, because also we actually were just talking about this before the show, but we talked about the difference between like farms that are organic or otherwise and just how expensive it is to become organic certified, and yet these small farms are now getting like pushed out of the market because of the actual like way in which we are marketing organic produce.
The organic designation being a little bit hard to attain for some farmers who are already doing those practices.
Exactly. And so just recognizing that those farmer, like the sustainability of that chain requires money, right?
Right.
Requires resources.
So basically what you're saying is like, well, basically how I look at it is, right, you're not really paying for the food. You're paying for the labor. You're paying for someone to actually put this on your plate. I mean, people go to restaurants.
It's
like really
excellent point. Yeah,
they go to like high-end restaurants, and then they sit down and spend thousands and thousands of dollars on high-priced booze, high-priced meat, whatever. You know, that same meat that's on those like restaurant tables could be on your plate. You know, you just do the labor. Mm-hmm. I mean, and one thing that Jared likes to bring up is people should be able to look their food in the face. I mean, if you actually raised a pig, would you eat a pig? Would you eat a cow if you raised it? Like, so, I mean,
I think some
that's
farmers,
what you're paying for.
Right, exactly. And some farmers would say, how can you eat something that you don't know how it's raised?
So that's what people are really paying for. You're paying for the hard work, blood, sweat, and tears that someone put into this.
Yeah.
You're not paying for the food. You're paying for that to continue to do.
Right. So to that end, do you guys have any guidelines around your sourcing mechanisms? Do you work with, like, what do you look for when you are looking for producers and farmers to partner with?
Yeah.
Reputable suppliers, or we talk to Jared.
Yeah, that's true. So Jared's really in charge of all of our sourcing, and it is about how food is raised, how food is grown, the ethical practices and the impact on the environment. But then, you know, to Fred's point and to your point as well, it is also about, you know, as much as we can learn about what the labor practices are of a particular place too. I mean, I think that is something that is often undervalued in the conversation around food justice, is how are, you know, big farms treating their people that are working on them. And that's something I think more and more, and Drive Change wants to be also at the forefront of the conversation around, what does it mean to be a socially conscious consumer? You know, how do we encourage radical transparency in a way that really gets us into a position and into a place where, you know, again, maybe you don't want to read an essay before you eat every meal, but at the same time, you know, I personally am going to want to support with the money and dollars that I choose to put towards entities, the ones that are thinking about these things and up and acting in a way that is socially responsible.
Right. And we have actually seen, and this, a rise in popularity of mission-based startups.
Right.
And also food trucks. Has this affected the business at all in any way over the past few years?
Yeah, so, you know, it's amazing. I think, so we started in 2014, and since then we know directly that there are a few other organizations that have started food trucks that have a mission-driven purpose, mm-hmm. be it something that has to do more specifically with food access or has to do with supporting other kinds of marginalized communities by way of employment or, again, running these educational programs as well. And that, you know, is something that we are just totally encouraging, you know, mm-hmm. thinking about how encouraging beyond the food truck industry. How does a business in general be a platform for being able to contribute socially?
To educate, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Definitely.
And, you know, I think one of the things that we run up against is also recognizing that there are small business owners with real bottom lines and real, you know, they have to make real assessments around the cost analysis for different things that they choose to invest in and do. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very real thing. However, what we've seen in our operation as well is that, you know, the ability to think about the fabric of your company, a company is a micro culture. It's a micro right. environment. You get to set values for that. And in reality, I think that that's really a place for potential reform.
Yeah.
And so we've seen that it's been a benefit for our bottom line to be able to have such clear value and principle going into what we do. It gives 100%. Us clarity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think that we're seeing more and more this, the notion that you can do well by doing good in a business, you know, take off and be successful, right? You can do both, like be profitable and make big changes on the communities in which you are serving.
Yeah, and understand, I mean, I say often, like, you know, I think social enterprise has gotten pretty trendy and pretty buzzy, and I think we have to be aware of that, too. Like,
if it's, you mean aware of like the kind of greenwashing effect, or if it's just a marketing principle?
Yeah, definitely. And just also too, like, that's definitely what I mean. But also then thinking, like, when I think about it, I often say that I want to be in a position, or want us to all be in a place where the phrase social enterprise becomes obsolete, because every business would be formed with like actual KPIs around social good.
Yeah.
And that is something that I, you know, hope to be able to be a part of.
Absolutely. All right. We have time for one final question. I want to know what's next for both of you. Fred, kick us off. What do you have going on? What's next?
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I'm kind of like finding my way as of now. I mean, I didn't know I liked food as much until, you know,
the program.
Yeah, and then before I knew it, I'm working in Raynaud's, and you know, maybe I spent a couple of years at Raynaud's, you know, enhancing my skills, you know, getting to work around some of the greatest cooks, you know, New York has to offer. Yeah. And see where it goes from there. Right now, I'm doing the parenting thing, raising the kids, and
awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty much right now for me.
And infusing them, helping to develop their culinary palettes as well, I assume.
Oh,
or
man.
Do you cook for them?
I cook right now. My two oldest, they're pretty much cooking for themselves.
Oh my gosh!
They won't leave me alone. Like, they're in the kitchen with me. Like, oh,
yeah.
Can I do this? Can I do this? And then you really have to like find out which things they can do safely.
Yeah.
So it's like, mash these potatoes.
Yeah.
Add this in there, and oh, these are the best potatoes ever. Oh, you did such a good job. So it's like,
that's amazing, yeah. And such an important thing to do, I think, with your kids, and I love that. Jordan, what's next for Drive Change? Any plans for expansion, growth?
Yeah, we want to build this commissary. So we got to raise some money. We got to be in a position where we can potentially lease. We're looking for like around a 30,000 square foot space. So not small at all.
Yeah.
And really building this ecosystem that allows for other mobile vendors at this point to be a part of the work that we're doing and be a part of the mission. So they would come into the commissary, and then they'd be required required to work with young people coming home from the system in different capacities, and that they would get a Drive Change affiliation. So that's really exciting. We feel clear about that pathway and excited to bring a better version of the commissary to New York City. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, you know, if we can figure out how that works, try to replicate that in another city. Unfortunately, there are way too many young people who are affected by the system in our country. That is the pathway, you know, and hopefully we can create, you know, connections and opportunities too for people like Fred to be able to be connected and potentially even come back and be a part of our bigger vision and team moving forward. So,
once your culinary skills are completely perfected by some of the best chefs.
They're pretty good.
Yeah.
I like that idea. I mean,
yeah.
Coming in, pushing people around.
In the best possible way.
Oh, in the most best. Like, when you think about being a cook, you know, you usually, let's say now, we're not in the We Chef era right now. Most of the cooks, when they're screaming at you, they're screaming at you, like, because they see so much great in you. Like, they want you to be great.
So yeah.
You don't take anything personal.
Yeah. Definitely so many great life lessons to be learned in the kitchen and out with the organization. Okay, so thank you. I want to thank you so much. We're going to wrap it up for today. Jordan and Fred, you guys were great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. For more information on Drive Change, go to drivechangenyc.org. I also want to thank our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with the help from Taylor Lanzette, and show music is by the talented Tim Archer. Thank you to our show engineer, Pierre Bien-Aimé, and David Tadashore. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage Radio Network's website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook, and be sure to find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Lee Ute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Subscribe.